Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We're glad to have you all here for our third oral submission of the day. I understand that counsel have announced their appearances and the time that they wish to argue. And if everyone is ready to proceed, I will have the clerk call your case. Counsel ready?
Yes, ma'am.
The court will now call Jeffrey Templeton versus RKR Investments. And may it please the court, Mr. Mark Zimmerman to argue for the appellant, Mr. Sean Mooney to argue for the appellee.
Good morning. My name is Mark Zimmerman. May it please the court. I represent Jeff Templeton. Mr. Templeton, I have a chart here. I'd like to, if I may, move it over a little bit. Because this plays very much into our argument. Mr. Templeton is an owner and a director of RKR Investments, the company circled in red. And it's a Nevada corporation, and it is its principal place of business is in Tarrant County. The overview of our case is pretty simple. We're here today because the court appointed a receiver. And under Nevada law, we're appealing that installation of receiver. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. And our argument is that the district court abused its discretion in appointing a receiver over this corporation because there's no evidence. And that's really not disputed. I read the brief of my opponent. He doesn't say there's any evidence.
Counsel, didn't you agree to the appointment of a receiver?
I knew you were going to ask that, Your Honor, and the answer is no. We talked about, let me tell you how this went in the district court. Judge Evans didn't care what we called it. He said, I don't care whether he called it a receiver, conservator, or a donut maker in Canada. I don't care. I'll decide what you're going to call, what we're going to have here. I'll decide, okay? So we gave him some facts, and he decided a receiver. No, I did not agree, and the counsel already acknowledged that is a red herring because page 16 of his brief, he acknowledges that we always wanted a custodian. I don't think that exists under Texas law, but it does exist under Nevada law. And no, I never agreed to a receiver. There were facts stipulated to, but nowhere did I stipulate that we want a receiver.
Well, counsel, I'm looking at the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that there's a place in the record where the court says, let me see if I understand the basic outline of an agreement between the parties without taking or contracting. The parties have agreed that pursuant to the applicable Nevada law that a receivership, that facts exist for the appointment of a receivership in this case. And counsel for Templeton says yes. So is that not an agreement?
No, because it was applicable Nevada law. The entire time I was arguing that Nevada 78347 is the applicable. The question is, what is the applicable law? As the judge says, he'll call it whatever he wants to call it. And 347 there's also talks about a receiver, but it's a custodian. So it's not labels, it's substance. What statute are we talking about? And the judge the next day, or the next hearing, says, I know you didn't have an agreement. He knew there was never an agreement as to receiver.
What is that on the record somewhere?
Yes, ma'am.
What's the record citation for that?
I can give it to you.
Thank you.
Can't do it this minute. But yes, I can give it to you. Have I answered your question?
Yes.
Thank you. There's 2 points of our argument. One is lack of evidence. And the other is the Rule 11 agreement precludes.
How can there be lack of evidence if you stipulated that there was evidence supporting the appointment of a receiver?
Well, there was evidence supporting the appointment of a custodian. Remember, applicable law. This is the judge talked about. He said he didn't care about the label. What he cared about was what facts. And he said in the record, and we can point this to you too, said in the record, I will decide what this calls for, whether it's a receiver or custodian. I will decide that. I don't even want you guys to argue it. And that's the last word, the last hearing. That's where we had the last hearing. He said, I don't want you guys to argue what this is. I'm going to decide, and you just tell me what you can agree to. And yes, we stipulated to some facts, as most litigants do, but the facts do not justify a receiver. None of them do. So there is no evidence, and there is no agreement, and the district judge acknowledged that when he said, I know you didn't have an agreement. So, and if I will point these specific pages out to the court.
That would be good.
All right.
Mr. Zimmerman?
Yes, sir.
Would you address the provision of the Texas law under the Business Organization Code, Title 1, Chapter 11, Section 11.410, A and B? Doesn't that specifically give the district court the authority to appoint a receiver for a foreign corporation doing business in Texas?
I can't answer that question without it in front of me, but I would say the district court believed Nevada law applied. It specifically made that finding. It asked for a stipulation to apply Nevada law, so I would say that that question was not before the court.
The judge said, I'll appoint who I want to appoint based on the evidence given to me as a district judge, and this is a governing statute in the state of Texas governing the activities of a district judge.
But he appointed the receiver under Nevada 78650. That's what his order says. So that's the criteria he used.
Let me look at the order again. I didn't see that.
May I proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right.
In other words, what you just said to me is you don't believe Section 11.410 applies in this case.
I do not. And I don't believe the district judge did either, because
something that bugs me.
Yes, sir.
Okay? From the briefing, you make it absolutely clear that the appointment of a receivership under Nevada law is different than an appointment of a custodian.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do they have identical factual predicates? I don't remember seeing that with regard to your briefing. So why, if you agree that there are facts sufficient for a receivership and the use of that term is being used under Nevada law by the trial court, why are you agreeing that there are facts sufficient for a receivership if they don't have the same factual predicate? Why should we think that you're agreeing? Because basically what you're arguing is that your agreement on the record was you agreed that there was an evidentiary predicate for a custodian, and that Judge Evans was just confused as to what he was referencing there. And that might be discernible, that might be okay, if the factual predicate for both a receiver and a custodian are the same, because then I'm agreeing to a custodian, but he's characterizing it as a receiver, but it's still the same facts. But if it's not the same factual predicate, then you've agreed to the facts for a receiver, because that's a different factual predicate. Why should we not make that determination?
Well, the question, as I understand it, is the factual predicate the same for both?
Right.
It's so similar that it is very similar. What the results are very
different. In other words, they're so similar that we should credit your argument that you, when you said, yes, there's a factual predicate for a receiver, were actually saying, yes, there's a factual predicate for a custodian.
Yes, there is a factual predicate for a custodian. I would say that's correct. The difference, though, is how it's treated. The difference is a custodian's principal role is not to dissolve the corporation and sell it off. So it's the predicate is the same, but the outcome is a little different.
Why should we not take just Judge Evans's discussions with regard to he's going to decide whether it's a receiver or custodian? All he's saying is he's going to be, which he can under Texas law, determine what the authority of the receiver has. He could have said, I'm going to appoint a receiver, but I'm not going to grant the receiver the authority to dissolve the corporation.
Perhaps, but under the custodian statute, which I preferred, it's statutory that the custodian does not dissolve the corporation and sell off its assets, which is happening today. as we speak, I mean, in the process.
Okay, I have another question for you here. You sent in a November 2nd letter that included a proposed receivership order and suggested that the receiver should have the freedom to perform an audit or any other investigation if he deems it material. How is not that a waiver of your right to be here complaining about the order appointing a receiver?
The judge asked for orders. I gave him orders. What is the correct response? Your Honor, I'm not going to give you an order. You know, it's like when you lose a case and you're supposed to confer with counsel and come up with an order. All right, I made a pitch. Of course I did. Anybody would do that. In fact, that's required. It doesn't mean agreement. When you lose a case, a jury trial, and the judge says work on an agreed order, agreed judgment, that doesn't mean you agree that should happen.
Actually, it does. When you submit a judgment and you don't qualify it by saying you're submitting it as to form only, then you've waived any complaint about the judgment. That applies to orders as well.
All right. But I would say the district court was fully aware that there was never a waiver and there was never an agreement on a receiver because he said so. And he said right at the end, I know there's no agreement, but you want as a custodian. And I can cite you the page, and I will. We'll give you a letter to that. All right.
Sir, the panel is aware that you have also filed a motion seeking a stay.
Yes, ma'am.
Of something that is supposedly going to happen tomorrow.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And is that the sale of the business?
Tomorrow. Well, when I filed that motion, there were two subsidiaries whose assets were being sold. One, they're signing a contract. They're getting permission to sign a contract tomorrow for a broker, which will cost them $250,000, whether it's sold or not. The other company, the other division, this one, LLC, as I understand it, there is already a contract for sale, and there's a hearing in July to confirm that sale.
And so there's nothing that's supposed to happen tomorrow except for the hiring of a broker.
That's, yes, ma'am. When I filed it, I thought LFC could be sold at any time. And as far as I know, LFC could be sold because the court does advance dates sometimes. Yes, we're set in July, but he could move it up. He's done that before. So that's one of the, that's what's happening tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, in any case, Jeff Templeton asked for a jury trial. The way this started, Jeff Templeton wanted to look at the books and records of some of these divisions. That's all this case is about. Let me look at the books and records. And the company throws him out, and to the tune of $500,000, fighting him on looking at these books and records. If these assets get sold, there's nothing to have a trial about. His trial is to look at the books and records of the company and look not only at the QuickBooks, but the primary documents, the bills of lading, the inventory, things like that. He's entitled to look at these things. They're all going out the door. And that's why we need a stay. We don't want them going out the door. And they wouldn't let him look at the books and records. The case has been fought for a long time.
Mr. Zimmerman?
Yes, sir.
I read the statements that was covered by Ms. Gray in working up the agreed order, Rule 11 agreement.
Yes, sir.
And it was stated in there specifically that there would be records pulled and placed on disk and provided to your client. Did your client get those records?
Yes, those are QuickBooks bank records. Yes, sir.
So your client got the records that he was looking for,
no,
correct?
No, sir.
Well, then why did you agree to the Rule 11 if you didn't get the agreements, the records that you wanted?
It was a temporary agreement. It came in the midst of a temporary injunction. And it did not provide, it's a temporary injunction. It wasn't the final ruling. The case continued. Regardless of the Rule 11, the case continued. And what he wants is the primary records here, because anybody can mess with QuickBooks.
What do you mean by primary records? You mean he wants the original record books in his hands?
I think he wants to see, the only way you can tell whether somebody is shorting inventory is actually to probably count the inventory. And we would like to set an accounting team in there to look at it and haven't been allowed to do that. I mean, it's a simple thing. Let's see if there's 12 nuts. Are there 12 nuts? At some point, this company has never been audited. and it cries out for auditing. These two divisions here share one bank account. The books are a mess. And so whether one is making money or one is losing money, it's simply impossible to tell unless somebody gets their hands dirty and looks into these things. And the accounting records, there's, I think, seven sets of books in these companies.
All right. I'm going to just point one thing out to you, and then I'm going to leave you alone and let you finish your argument.
Okay.
The last sentence in the order appointing receiver, first paragraph.
Yes, sir.
Says that the receiver is appointed for RKR Investments, Inc. under Nevada Revised Statute 78.650 and Texas Business Organization Code 11410. That's what it says, or those are the basis for the appointment of the receiver. So when I asked you about 410 a while ago, it is specifically mentioned as the authority for the district court's action in appointing a receiver. Well, in addition to the Nevada law.
I think he felt that he needed a Texas law to get him into the Nevada law. That's the way I understand that. Because everybody conceded Nevada law applies. Any further questions? My light went on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sean Looney. I represent, along with Linda Kirkley, Bob Reese, who is the trustee of the Bobby Neal Reese Revocable Trust, intervened in the lawsuit below. May it please this honorable court. The issue that you're asking about, Your Honor, with Texas Business Organizations Code 11.410, that gives the authority to the court to apply the law of the foreign jurisdiction. So that is the entryway into then allowing the Texas court to apply the Nevada statute to appoint the receiver. And so that's why both statutes are cited. It doesn't reference specifically the standards to apply, but it says that when you have a foreign entity, then you use that foreign law, and that's what gives the Texas court the authority to apply that foreign law. The question here before the court today is, did the trial court abuse its discretion by appointing a receiver? There are four issues that are raised in the appellant's brief, but that is the seminal issue that's before the court. And the question and the answer to that question is no, because the trial court had substantive and probative evidence before it in order to justify the appointment of the receiver under Nevada law. Nevada statute is very specific. It gives 10 instances, 78650 is the Nevada statute, gives 10 specific instances under which courts are authorized to appoint a receiver. We applied under two different instances. The first is subsection D, which discusses the inability of the business to conduct business or conserve its assets by reason of the act, neglect, or refusal to function of a director. The second subsection is E, and that is the section that refers to the assets of the corporation being in danger of waste, sacrifice, or loss through litigation or otherwise. So the evidence that we presented to the court for subsection D talked about the behavior of in this situation where you've got the holding company, RKR Investments, Inc., the two directors, and they stipulated to the fact that the two directors were deadlocked. They can't appoint officers. They can't do anything for the holding companies because they're deadlocked on this issue. And the deadlock stems that the evidence that the court had before, in addition to the Rule 11 and the fact that Director Templeton did not move forward on the Rule 11 and the agreed-upon procedures, the evidence that they had was that this wasn't simply a business decision of rejecting the sale. This was based on he wanted this audit. And, as he's represented again today, that he does not trust the underlying books. And so you've got a bigger issue here in terms of the disputes between the directors. So what was required and what the reason that he stipulated to it is because he recognized that a third party was necessary to come in this situation. And his statements about calling it a custodian or calling it a receiver in that situation, the reason he changed tune on that was because he'd already agreed to it. And the only question that was before the court was what the order was going to say, because they wanted the order to have it built in an audit. And we disputed that that order should have the audit built in. And then on, after it's, you know, 2 weeks later when we come to the hearing, now it's we're going to appoint a custodian. Now that was a switch in the move. So that's why you get the stipulation to the receiver and to the facts appointing the receiver, to the fact that there's a deadlock, and the fact that the directors were not going to resolve this issue.
Do you agree with counsel that the factual predicate for a receivership under Nevada law and the factual predicate for a custodianship under Nevada law are not identical? They're similar but not identical?
I agree with that, Your Honor. And in addition to that, I would actually add that the factual predicate for establishing a custodian requires irreparable harm. It requires it, if you read it. So he's actually stipulating that that because of the division between the directors, that there's irreparable harm by applying for the custodian. Under subsection E, which is where we had all of our evidence, this is the issue of the assets being in danger of waste and sacrifice or loss through litigation. And that's the evidence that we presented to the court about what is going on at LFC. You've got a company that was set up by three men, two of which are now deceased. The only remaining owner of the company, founder of the company, is our client, Mr. Reese. Director Templeton was appointed because of, by virtue of ownership of stock in a estate, in the estate of one of the deceased former owners. The employees are aging. Management is getting toward retirement age. The equipment is aging. The industry is globalizing. They don't have the ability to compete the same way that they used to be able to compete. All these things were presented to the court. And all this information, the healthcare costs are rising. I mean, they had all kinds of issues that we presented to the court showing that LFC is in dire straits when it comes to their future. There was an offer on the table to buy it at not just liquidation value, but at something more than that. And that was what our client was concerned about losing, and that's the danger. And then under the statute, under the receivership statute, it is not, we do not have to show that waste is occurring right then or that loss is occurring right then. It's the danger of it. And in this situation, the adage of time kills deals. You've got a corporation that everything is trending this way, and you've got a director saying, I don't trust the books, I don't have anything, you know, I don't trust this, and I need more information, when pursuant to the Rule 11 agreement, he'd been given that information. He'd been given all this stuff to evaluate, and he still came in and said, I don't have enough information. And the next day, he followed up with a request for another audit. So our client's looking at this and saying, the grapes are dying on the vine. You've got to move. And that's why we applied for the receiver under that section, and we provided ample evidence to the court of the struggles that LFC was going through. And understanding that in this structure, the holding company, the business of the holding company is the subsidiaries. The fact that, you know, pointing out and saying, well, the directors are up at the top level, but the directors are looking at, these are the assets of the holding company. So those directors are looking at, how do we maximize the assets below us? There has to be the receiver appointed at that level. Appointing a receiver anywhere else doesn't give him the authority or him or her the authority to do what they need to do as far as selling the real estate and the businesses combined. So you have to look at appointing a receiver on the top level holding company. In addition to the issues that are going on at LFC, the simple fact that we're engaged in this litigation over the directors is more evidence of waste. As he said, there's been attorney's fees expended, not only attorney's fees, but accounting fees in trying to produce the information that he's requested, trying to get experts involved and do all the things to appease what the directors asked for. And in addition, there's also been a payment of attorney's fees to Director Templeton to cover attorney's fees that he spent in trying to get the record. So the statute specifically references litigation as a source of waste or loss. So it is clear that the list of litigation is something that's contemplated by the receivership statute. On the other issues that really haven't been discussed yet, you know, the issue before the court of appointing a custodian, I think it's been conceded at this point based on the reply brief that the court doesn't have the jurisdiction to appoint a custodian and reverse and appoint a custodian instead. That seemed to be what was indicated in the initial briefing, but this court doesn't have that authority under the statute allowing for interlocutory appeals, just like you don't have the ability to review the denial of a receivership. It's only the appointment of a receivership. In this situation, the court denied the appointment of the custodian. Similarly, there's been, in the briefing, there's a reference to the Rule 11 agreement that was entered into between the company and Director Templeton early on in the case. Somehow there's an allegation that that applies to our client, even though our client's not a signatory to the agreement, doesn't have anything to do with the agreement. There's a reference that he's somehow getting a benefit from that agreement. In looking at, you know, in the briefing that we presented, I think we show that, first of all, we are not suing based upon that Rule 11 agreement. What we've said in our pleading is that his failure to comply and to move forward with the agreed-upon procedures are evidence of the breach of fiduciary duty. But that breach of fiduciary duty comes from his responsibilities as a director. It doesn't come from his obligations underneath the Rule 11 agreement. So it's not the same kind of concept with the direct benefits estoppel.
And Mr. Templeton agreed by vote to explore sale of assets. Is that not correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so there was an actual meeting of the directors, a vote was taken, and he and your client agreed to explore possible sale of assets based upon whatever presentation was made at that meeting.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I would add to that, that was also done when Kelly Kuntz, one of the former directors who's now deceased, was still there. And Mr. Kuntz agreed as well.
So it was a three-director vote.
At that time, it was a three-director vote.
He passed away subsequent to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But the vote to explore sale of assets, that was not a vote to obligate sale. There still had to be a subsequent vote to agree to a sale. Is that correct?
I agree with that, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. But now, because of the death of Mr. Kuntz, you now have two directors, and they are now opposed with regard to moving forward with that, which is why you sought the receivership.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Mr. Kuntz, how is it that you ended up with two directors? Does the organizational structure of this Nevada corporation, doesn't it provide for a mechanism to replace a director who died?
These directors had a very specific shareholder agreement, Your Honor. And under that shareholder agreement, when Mr. Kuntz died, the stock interest that he held was acquired by the company. And so the way that the shareholder agreement sets up is that each of the original owners had a shareholder group and got to appoint a director for that shareholder group. When his interest was bought out, that shareholder group was eliminated, so now you have no director there. And when Mr. Ramsey died, a portion of the stock was bought out, but not all of it. So you still had that shareholder group existing, and then Mr. Reese's shareholder group. So it's because of the foundational documents that we ended up with two directors, and the buyout of Mr. Kuntz's stock interest. Another issue that's raised in the briefing is this question of harm, and whether or not there's a required showing of harm in order to, and I think that issue's changed. It's modified a little bit from the original briefing to the subsequent briefing. The original issue was that we were required to show harm in order to justify the appointment of the receiver. I think it's pretty clear from the face of the statute that that's not required, that the statute has the very specific language of the statute says what is required. After that, as far as that's been twisted, I think, now to say that it's justifying, you have to show harm to justify the injunction. And there again, the statute does not require that, and it wouldn't make any sense in this situation. It does, obviously, under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, when you've got to show harm to go out to get an injunction, that situation makes sense. But here, the injunction is necessary in order to keep a rogue director from being able to commit the corporation to something when you've got a court-appointed receiver. It's to preserve the court's authority there. So, you know, to attach a harm requirement to it, some of those circumstances under the statute that allow for appointment receiver don't necessarily have any fault element to them. So to attach a harm requirement, read that into that statute, it would undercut the purpose of the statute, and it would also eliminate the ability of the court to put in the injunction to preserve its own power, because the receiver is an arm of the court. So that's what the injunctive relief is there for, and there's just simply no requirement for showing harm. In response to a couple of the issues that were raised, I think we've addressed most of those. I would say that LFC cannot be sold without the court's approval. There's no secret sale that's going to happen or anything like that. The court has to approve it. Judge Evans put that specifically in the order. I would also add that the order is not a mandate to sell. If you look at the language of the order says to investigate whether or not a sale is in the best interest of the companies. So as far as what he's arguing with regard to a custodian, I would say that Judge Evans pretty much gave him what he wanted, that it's not required that this receiver is not charged to go and liquidate the companies. The receiver's in there to investigate and look at it. And as a matter of fact, it gives him the authority to do an inventory, which I believe is what he mentioned that they wanted. And the discussion about not being able to get an accounting team in there, there's no one to blame in that situation but himself. I mean, the agreed-upon procedures were set in place and he refused to proceed with them. So stalling and not getting the accounting team in there when he agreed under the Rule 11 to certain procedures to implement, he didn't do that.
The role of the accounting team would have been to go back to the brass tacks and determine if the books were in fact supported by the data that was accessible to the accounting team.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think specifically with regard to inventory, that seems to be one of the issues. We've never quite gotten an articulated
issue. What is it that needs to be counted in terms of inventory?
From our position, nothing, Your Honor. From their position, screws and bolts.
Would not an inventory necessarily have to be done with regard to be able to make appropriate representations about what assets are being sold to a third party?
I think, yes, Your Honor.
They're buying nuts and bolts, so they need to know how many nuts and bolts they're buying.
I think to a degree. Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry. Yes, to a degree, I believe that an inventory would need to be. But obviously, when you're talking about a mass quantity item like that, in terms of what number you have to get down to, I'm not sure on that.
Mass quantity of what? I'm looking for what is it that needs to be counted in order. I understand you need to have a proper description in a sale document. What is it that you're under? What is your understanding of what Mr. Zimmerman's client wants to count?
I would say that that's never been clearly articulated to me, but from what information we do have as to what has gone forward, it's the screws and bolts and the things that LFC manufactures. That's what they manufacture, fasteners for the airline industry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Looney.
I want to address something that I forget which justice mentioned it. This isn't a two-director issue. The agreed facts are unanimous consent of the Board of Directors is necessary to execute LOIs. That was in the original paperwork. It isn't a two-director issue. One director, 20 directors, 1,000 directors, one director can veto a sale. And that's the way this was set up.
So the death of Mr. Koontz doesn't matter with regard to approval of sale?
It doesn't matter. If there were 12 directors, one could still knock it out. That's what the founding documents say. And it's extreme remedy to have the court come in and decide what should be done when these directors set it up that way. There's no evidence that the business is not operating. There's no evidence that they're losing money. What they want you to focus on continually is just one division of stuff of the whole. There's no evidence at all that the company, the only company here, is limited, is it's losing money. And the statute says the corporation. The only corporation here is the one in red. There's no evidence at all that the corporation has lost a dime. So it's kind of like, let's shut down General Motors because one of its subs that makes push carts is losing money. You can't do that under the statute. The corporation has to be losing money. There's no evidence at all. In fact, the president said, I don't know. So there's no evidence that the corporation is losing money. And why I talk about the corporation, this LLC does not stand by itself. It's a division. Plus, we have another sub over here. There's no evidence that the corporation itself is losing any money. So we're putting a whole corporation into receivership because one division may or may not be losing money. The other item is, what you're looking at is the books of these companies are commingled. One has $1,000. Whose money is it? And that's what Mr. Templeton would like to find out, to sort that out. And if you sort that out, it could be that these divisions are worth more with good books than with bad books. The waste Mr. Rooney talked about seems to be a self-inflicted wound. They spent $500,000 to not let Mr. Templeton sort out these books. Why would anybody do that? I don't think self-inflicted wounds count as waste. And the Gagliani case, which we cited, sets a high level of what waste is. Going back to the Rule 11 agreement, I think if you look at the petition, they did sue under the petition. They alleged they had a jurisdiction against Mr. Templeton under the Rule 11 agreement and sought to enforce it. Well, you can't say you're not party to a contract and still sue under it, which is what he did. So that means he is a party of the contract, and therefore the court ordered no one should bring an action, and he did. He should not be here today. He should not have filed the action because the court order prohibited that action. I want to add deadlock. We talked about deadlock. Deadlock is not in the statute. Nowhere in 650 does the word deadlock appear. That's not a requirement. In fact, it's not even mentioned. And the statute itself focuses on the corporation. There's a reason for that, because you could have 12 subs and focusing on one sub and putting it in receivership because of the failure of one sub is preposterous. Shouldn't be done.
Mr. Zimmerman?
Yes, sir.
On page 18 of the appellee's brief, on behalf of Mr. Reese, on page 18 it says that LFC, I understand, that's one section of the two divisions that are making up the RKR Technologies Limited and then goes up to the RKR Investments, Inc. I understand the structure. But this says on this representation on page 18 that LFC lost $450,000 in 15, $670,000 in 16, and was on pace to lose $775,000 in 17. Those are numbers in the appellee's brief. You dispute those?
Yes, sir. We would like to have an opportunity to show that those numbers are not correct, because we're not allowed in to look at this what's going on here. We have two companies side by side, two divisions. The company's making money. The division may be losing money, maybe not. There's funny things in the books. There's $2 million here, and then there's $2 million here. Well, that means, does that mean there's $2 million, or does it mean there's $2 million? That's one of the problems we've had with this issue from the get-go. We want to go in and have somebody do a forensic audit.
Wasn't that what was going to happen under the Rule 11 agreement? Had your client agreed to the appointment of the people that were going to do the job?
No, sir, and the Rule 11 agreement has still not been completed because they're sitting on it. They've sat on it since September when we signed a contract letting a common company go forward. We still don't have a result at all, and the procedures were limited. There's more than 10 procedures that people can do. This was a temporary discovery issue, as the judge pointed out, and it only was limited. And like I said, we don't have an answer, not because we sat on it, because they're still sitting on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. Thank you, Mr. Looney. We appreciate your arguments in this case here before us today. Your case is submitted, and our clerk will adjourn court.
All rise.